Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we are discussing Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte, Chapter 3, and then we'll be reading Chapter 4. The questions that I asked you guys were these. A lot of dream sequence stuff here in Chapter 3. What latent symbology do you detect? This might just be my own confusion, but who did he return home to in this chapter? Have we met these characters yet? That's just kind of clearing up my own confusion more than anything. And lastly, does anyone want to have a guess at the history behind this place and the names that seem to echo throughout its history? Techrific, coming in with the vocab needed. Vapid listlessness means bereft of strength or energy to do anything. Spectres are ghosts. Dilapidation is decay, crumbling and falling apart. A garret is here, an unfinished part of a house just under the roof. Palaver is idle talk between two people. Pinafores is sleeveless dresses or garments worn over dresses. Asseverated means spoken earnestly. Lachrymose means mournful or tearful. Cudgel is a short club. Casement, a window with side hinges that open outward. A waif is a homeless, neglected or abandoned person, especially a child. Changeling is a child switched with another in infancy. In Celtic and Nordic myths, a changeling was believed to be a fairy child that had been left in place of a human child stolen by the fairies. Appellation is a name or title. Stagnate means to be motionless. Impudence means boldness. Sotto voce means under one's breath, or so as not to be overheard. Egress is an exit. Decorum, polite behavior. And benumbed means deprived of physical or emotional feeling, usually through being cold, i.e. numbed. Awesome. Thank you very much, Tech. Techrific also said this, loads to unpack, a lot was revealed, but even more questions were raised. First of all, vinegar-faced Joseph has been prick in every timeline so far, but even more so, it seems, in the past. We're introduced to Catherine, who in youthful exuberance seemed to have developed a bit of graphomania, scribbling not only in her books, but on the wood in her room. She seemed to have contemplated marriage to two separate fellows, Heathcliff, who we know, and somebody called Linton. We don't know if these carvings were done at the same time, indicating a possible love triangle, or if the carvings were done at different times. I love that the story in Chapter 3 is almost like a case of Russian dolls, where we're presented with stories within stories. Lockwood jotting down his harrowing experience at Wuthering Heights, followed by Catherine's marginalia diary and woodcrafting attempts, then Lockwood's fevered dreams, which featured a supernatural encounter with Catherine. Let me in. I'm loving it. We're also introduced to Hindley Earnshaw and his wife, Frances, who seem like a despicable pair. Hindley even drags his wife into the bullying by demanding that she pull the hairs of Catherine. What a family. Heathcliff and Lockwood also have an interesting exchange in this chapter, and Heathcliff seemed haunted himself by what Lockwood divulged to him. I'm surprised by this book. I'm loving every aspect of it, and it's quite frankly a godsend compared with Dubliners. Hagia Moron said, hey, Hagia Moron, I think, is this the first time I've read one of your comments? Or have I just forgotten? Anyway, if it is, welcome to the podcast, Hagia Moron. In regards to question one, I was very confused about the whole 7x70 thing, so I looked up the reference, and apparently it comes from a biblical episode in which Jesus instructs Peter that it is not enough to forgive 7 times, but rather he must forgive 7x70. Also, apparently as Hebrew is alphanumeric, 490, which is 7x70, roughly translate as complete or perfect. When the pastor is reprimanding Lockwood, perhaps this is a manifestation of his own flaws and incompleteness. He certainly is thirsty for companionship, and the first chapter indicates he really bungled an attempt at love with the goddess. Maybe where, presumably, scary ghost Catherine comes through the window, this is a further manifestation of his desire for woman. women, but also his dire fear of them. She is simultaneously approaching him yet cold, literally. Basically, this boy has problems. Swim, said the mama fish. He said, I'll say that boy has problems. He threw Zillow right under a bus. His self-justification of his actions and blaming others is really beginning to irritate me. Swim, said the mama fish. He said, the diary entry in the book Lockwood is reading describes the three-hour sermon she and the other children endure. Then in Lockwood's dream, he endures a sermon based on the book with Joseph by his side, who happily starts beating him at the reverend command. Bronte Peer was a very active cleric, and Bronte was certainly in the thick of it all. So the fact that the diary is based on a religious tract and Lockwood's dream is based in the chapel with Joseph by his side, who preached at the children himself for 3 hours, who is more than happy to beat on at the reverend command, is very interesting. So ironic that the reverend preaches forgiveness, but yet it all ends in violence. I found a very interesting article that provides an analysis of Jabez Brandersham's sermon, but it contains spoilers, so I won't post it. Well, thank you for that. Regarding question two, I'm presuming it is the servants in the house he is renting that is greeting when he comes back. Cool. Well, that answers that question. Makes a lot of sense. Question three, I have no idea, but I bet it is going to be difficult keeping it all straight. A la War and Peace. I don't actually even remember what question three was. Does anyone have a guess at the history behind this place? We do have a lot of sort of repeating names and stuff. Ghosts from the past. I love that the setting has this depth to it, right? We don't really understand it yet, and we might not even become fully aware of the history, but it has that history. You can be sure of that. Hemingway himself said, paraphrasing, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was something like this. You should know absolutely everything there is to know about your characters in your book, and then omit all those details. So it's like you have a really clear picture of all the history of a character, or everything about them, but leave those details out and let those details come through by like kind of symbiosis. Wait, is that the word I mean? No. Symbiosis. What's the word I mean? Osmosis. That's the word I was going for. Osmosis. Smart science word is what I meant to say. But you don't tell the reader any of these things. You just keep them in your mind as you create the character, and they just sort of are there in the background. It just lends this depth to the character. Like, you suspect there's a lot to them, but of course you don't know everything. And that's really realistic, because that's how people are, you know. Even the closest person to you, you know, you have this sense that there is things about that person that you don't understand. And to bring that sense across to a reader, that's how you do that. I've always said, I've kind of used that as a jumping off point for settings as well. So I treat my settings in a book almost like a character, and it's the same thing. You need to know absolutely everything about this place, all throughout its history, and then, yeah, omit those details. And that's exactly what Bronte's done here. She kind of dropped us in the middle of this world that feels very real, but we kind of have to figure it out for ourselves, which is exactly what it would be like for our main character, whose name I keep forgetting, Lockwood. It would be exactly like that for Lockwood. You just sort of dropped in the middle of it. You know it's a real place, but you haven't figured it out yet. JMama8779 said, in response to your answer for question three, I agree, I'm having a hell of a time with these characters. Then there's a flashback diary within a diary. I imagine I'll be able to keep them all straight eventually, but for now it's still a mess. Yeah, it was like a diary within a diary, leading into a dream, leading back into the present time, and it was a very confusing sequence, but I'm comforted by the fact that I'm certain that Bronte intended for it to be confusing, dreamlike, a bit Yeah, a bit crazy. So if you wanted us to come out of that chapter with everything lined up nice and straight, I think we would have. So yeah, I'm not too fussed about the fact that it's a bit foggy. All About Alice said, I'd have to agree with a few other sentiments that this chapter is a little confusing. On the other hand, I love how indirectly Bronte paints the reader a picture of the past. There is a significant amount of character development without blatantly spelling it out for the reader. Since we're reading diary entries, it makes it much more realistic that we'd have to read between the lines, and I think it is well executed here. We have an insight now into Heathcliff's temperament, potentially made worse from losing a kind father figure in Mr. Earnshaw, only to be beaten down by Hindley. The pleading for Catherine, after hearing Mr. Lockwood say he'd been haunted by her, makes me think we can deduce that Catherine wanting to be Mrs. Heathcliff was a childish dream that gave way to a different reality, where Heathcliff further lost the only person in his life he may have loved or felt loved by. We're seeing themes of forgiveness by being overshadowed by resentment, a sermon on 7x70, forgiving your neighbour, not 7 times, but 7x70 times, is turned into a sermon on casting judgment. Wow, I gotta say, All About Alice, I've just been saying, you know, that whole thing was confusing, but it seems like for you took a lot more out of that than I did. You've straightened all that up, got all your ducks in a row, so well done, very well done. Wasm said, I really enjoyed how the dilapidated building is described here, a house with 2 rooms threatening speedily to determine into one. And also, here, I'm wondering why Bronte chose to omit swears, and employing an epithet as harmless as duck or sheep, but generally represented by a dash. And are the omitted epithets simply rhymes of duck and sheep, perhaps ease of being published? As to question 2, I believe he returns to the people keeping the house at Thrushcross Grange for him. Last chapter he mentioned a servant girl cleaning the chimney, which made him hurry with his visit to Wuthering Heights. My book has a family tree at the beginning, and I was trying to use it to figure out how everyone relates and how the family's past might have looked, but I think I'll need some more story for that. I also went looking for how the bed looked, and man, it seems like a real fire hazard, especially sleeping with a candle next to you. Have we got a picture here of the bed? Oh, okay, it's got a wooden wall all around it. Fair enough. It's like a room within a room. Who Was Once Delight said, it's not really clear if the Catherine ghost is a dream or not. I like to think not. But Lockwood's behaviour toward her is another hint that he is not quite the civilised innocent he seems to think he is in comparison to Heathcliff and the others. Maybe I'm being overly harsh in my judgment. I get that encountering a ghost in the middle of the night in a horrible house would be terrifying, and Lockwood admits that terror made him cruel, but scraping the arm of what has been described as a plaintive, crying little girl over a pane of glass until the blood flows freely seems particularly brutal. And again, this can be attributed to midnight terror, but did Lockwood never suspect for a minute that the girl was real? Yes, she does end up being a ghost, but keeping a tragic waif hidden away doesn't seem out of character from what we've seen of the family so far, and ghosts don't bleed, do they? It's been at least 15 years, and probably more like 20 since I've read Wuthering Heights, and I don't remember it bothering me before that Catherine's diary and Lockwood's narration render Joseph's Yorkshire dialect in exactly the same way. This time it really did. I think that somebody who grew up around Joseph would hear or understand him differently than someone meeting him for the first time. Wait, what's that mean? This time, I think someone who grew up around Joseph would hear and understand him differently than someone meeting him for the first time. And it seems unlikely that two people would invent the spelling Maester to capture his accent independently of each other. I could be wrong, though. Maybe phonics were taught as having more regular rules in that time. Yeah, I noticed that Joseph's dialect was spelled and captured the exact same way in the diary and in the narration. And I figured it was that the narrator is Lockwood. Lockwood had read the diary and seen the way in which Joseph's dialect was captured, and decided that when he wrote his account, which is the narrative, that he would copy that. That's what I figured anyway. All About Alice said, "The accents being written the same struck me as well. I imagine it was a stylistic choice to ensure character continuity, but pretty unlikely in reality. Unless we go into the what-ifs that Catherine wrote it clearly, and then Mr. Lockwood took the liberty to rewrite it in his diary as he'd imagined Joseph said it." Techrific said, "Very good point. I just sort of thought all's fair in love and dreams. However, you make a good point. His veneer of sophistication is about as thick as his King Lear quote from Chapter 2. JMama8779 said, "I'm wondering what the fate of Catherine and the others from the diary are. I might have missed something, but do we have any insight into that yet? I'm guessing that Catherine did not end up with Heathcliff and instead went with Linton." Waraka Akbar responded, saying, "Considering the fact that a cadaverous Catherine reached through the window and grabbed poor Dream State Mr. Lockwood, I fear she might be deceased. Perhaps she got lost in the snow bogs during a walk." J. Mama said, "I got the death or murder vibes too. I feel that Heathcliff's breakdown alludes to some tragedy there. Maybe the joint is haunted and that puts everyone in a foul mood." Well, that chapter, I think that chapter will be, uneducated guess, but I'm guessing it's going to be a bit of an outlier in that it was a more confusing chapter. I think that's not going to be the norm. And I'm okay for it to be a bit confusing. It was a dream sequence. Dream sequences rarely make sense in books. I've got to be honest, I'm a bit anti-dream sequence with my own writing. I do put them in there, but whenever I put them in, it's like, I know it's a cop-out because I can't think of like other filler sort of thing. It does help to lend a lot of symbology. It can help to push plot points forward. It can help even with exposition and things like that, but it's just a cop out, I think, because dreams are silly. Dreams are silly, you know. When someone tells you about a crazy dream they had and they're so amazed by how weird it was, but dreams are weird, right? So I don't know. Anyway. I always just think, like, when I read a dream sequence, I kind of like, you can skim through this probably and you're not going to miss much because nothing in this can be literal. It's just, yeah, it's meant to be a bit illogical. It's senseless. I reckon that'll be the, I'm going to have a guess and say that'll probably be the only dream sequence in the book. I might be really, really wrong, but that's my guess. My uneducated guess. All right. I think that's all the comments there was about Chapter 3. Yep. I want to tell you guys about something, actually, before we move on. Something I'm excited about. This is from my life as a publisher and a mentor to a young author. I think I've told you about Aaron before. Aaron Huggins. He was one of my students. I met him when he was in grade 6. He was a really talented writer at that time. Then he was a member of my after-school creative writing club. He was extremely talented then as well. He loves science fiction. He loves murder mysteries, like classic Agatha Christie murder mysteries. And he loves and funny, like British humor type stuff. He wrote a lot of like Doctor Who scripts back in the day when he was part of my after school club. And then mid last year, he sent me a manuscript of a novel that he'd finished, which I read and absolutely loved. It had the humor of like your Douglas Adams or Terry Pratchett sort of deal. It was a science fiction book set on an alien planet, but then it was like a cozy murder mystery. So I think predominantly the genre you would say is murder mystery, like your Agatha Christie type things, but it's like Agatha Christie meets Douglas Adams, and really funny. Anyway, I own a publishing label. Now, the thing about my publishing label, Upland Media, you might be familiar with it if you've bought the Hemingway List classic books. I haven't published much through it. I've published one anthology of short fiction by Aussie authors called Mixtape One. I've published the Hemingway List classics. Years and years ago, I published my own books through it because, well, that was why I created the label, actually, pretty much for tax purposes. I was self-publishing a novel, and I thought, well, if I make this a small business for tax purposes, that's better. So I came up with a catchy name, Up and Up Media, and a cool little logo, and then I kind of sat on that for like 3 years. I just owned this publishing label. I did nothing with it. The thing is, I didn't want it to be a self-publishing label, so I don't offer self-publishing. I suppose the only person in the world who could say it's a self-publishing label is me, because I did publish my own books through it back in the day. But I didn't want it to be that. So it's a very small label, very, very small, but I wanted it to cultivate a reputation for only publishing good books. So I kept my eye out. Nothing came along. And also, I was aware that it was going to be difficult for me to market any book that I published for someone else. Then Aaron came along with his book, and it was really good. It's a fantastic book. So that was the first check mark. The book is up to the quality standards. The second check mark is I knew I could market it because of his history with Launchpad, which is the creative writing club that I run. So I visit schools to do creative writing workshops, and I visit, like a dozen schools a year at least, and speak to something like, 1,000 kids, and speak to all the libraries and stuff like that. So I knew that him being a representative of Launchpad, I could then work him into the conversation and sort of promote his book directly to young readers via schools. So I'm like, wow, okay, that ticks every box. I can do him the service of marketing his book. So I can offer him something he sort of can't do himself in a way, because otherwise it would be like he could publish his own book. And that's what a publisher offers an author, really, is like, any author can publish their own book these days, but you can't market it in the way that a publisher can. anyway, we're going a little bit sidetracked here. You've probably got no interest in this whatsoever, but I figure that if you're interested in this podcast, you're slightly interested in the host, and this is kind of the big thing I've got going on right now. I'm super proud of this kid. So anyway, he's 15 years old. He's having his first book published, and it's really awesome. And today I launched the website for his book with the cover art. It's called Live a Little. It's got the blurb, and it's also available for pre-order. It's coming out next month, but you can pre-order the ebook on Kindle, or you can also pre-order a paperback. So, I don't know, I just wanted to share that with you guys. That's what I've been working on, well, most of this week, getting everything ready for pre-orders. It's been a heck of a lot of work. So, this is the website. I'll tell you the URL. It's Up and Up Media, upandupmedia.com.au. upandupmedia.com.au, and you'll see a button which says Live a Little. That's the name of his book. Go and have a look. I will put a link to that book, to that page as well, in the description for this episode. So if you on your podcasting app, you can look on the description. You should be able to find the link. You can click that link now, and the podcast, if you're using like a smartphone or whatever, it should keep playing. If you want to, have a look. I don't know. I was just excited to tell you guys that. I'm excited to sort of tell the world that. And, I just launched it today. And this is, I don't know, it's what's in my mind. So I hope you'll excuse me promoting my friend's book. All right. Let us move forward, hey? Let's move forward and read chapter 4. All right, here we go. Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, Chapter 4, goes a little bit like this. What vain weathercocks we are. I, who had determined to hold myself independent of all social intercourse, and thanked my stars that at length I had lighted on a spot where it was next to impracticable. I I, weak wretch, after maintaining till dusk a struggle with low spirits and solitude, was finally compelled to strike my colours, and under pretence of gaining information concerning the necessities of my establishment, I desired Mrs. Dean, when she brought in supper, to sit down while I ate it, hoping sincerely she would prove a regular gossip and either rouse me to animation or lull me to sleep by her talk. "You have lived here a considerable time," I commenced. "Did you not say 16 years? 18, sir. I came when the mistress was married, to wait on her after she died. The master retained me for this, his housekeeper."
"Indeed."
There ensued a pause. She was not a gossip, I feared, unless about her own affairs, and those could hardly interest me. However, having studied for an interval, with a fist on either knee and a cloud of meditation over her ruddy countenance, she ejaculated, "Times are greatly changed since then." "Yes," I remarked, "you've seen a good many alterations, I suppose." "I have, and troubles too," she said. "Oh, I'll turn the talk on my landlord's family," I thought to myself. "A good subject to start, and that pretty girl widow, I should like to know her history, whether she be a native of the country, or, as is more probable, an exotic that the surly indigne will not recognize for kin." With this intention, I asked Mrs. Dean why Heathcliff let Thrushcross Grange, and preferred living in a situation and residence so much inferior. "Is he not rich enough to keep the estate in good order?" I inquired. "Rich, sir," she returned. "He has nobody knows what money, and every year it increases. Yes, yes, he's rich enough to live in a finer house than this, but he's very near close-handed, and if he had meant to flit to Thrushcross Grange as soon as he heard of a good tenant, he could not have borne to miss the chance of getting a few hundreds more. It is strange people should be so greedy when they are alone in the world." "He had a son, it seems." "Yes, he had one. He is dead." "And the young lady, Mrs. Heathcliff, is he his widow?"
"Yes."
"Where did she come from originally?"
"Why, sir, she is my late master's daughter. Catherine Linton was her maiden name. I nursed her, poor thing. I did wish Mr. Heathcliff would remove her, and then we might have been together again."
"What, Catherine Linton?" I exclaimed, astonished. But a minute's reflection convinced me it was not my ghostly Catherine. "Then," I continued, "my predecessor's name was Linton."
"It was."
"And who is that Earnshaw, Harriton Earnshaw, who lives with Mr. Heathcliff? Are they relations?"
"No, he is the late Mrs. Linton's nephew."
"The young lady's cousin, then?"
"Yes, and her husband was her cousin also, one on the mother's. The one on the father's side, Heathcliff married Mr. Linton's sister."
"I see the house at Wuthering Heights has Earnshaw carved over the front door. Are they an old family?"
"Very old, sir, and Harriton is the last of them, as our Miss Cathy is of us, I mean, of the Lintons.
Have you been to Wuthering Heights? I beg pardon for asking, but I should like to hear how she is."
"Mrs. Heathcliff, she looked very well and very handsome, yet I think not very happy."
"Oh dear, I don't wonder. And how did you like the master?"
"A rough fellow, rather, Mrs. Dean. Is not that his character?"
"Rough as a saw edge and hard as whinstone. The less you meddle with him, the better."
"He must have had some ups and downs in his life to make him such a churl. Do you know anything of his history?"
"It's a cuckoo's, sir. I know all about it, except where he was born, and who his parents were, and how he got his money at first. And Harriton has been cast out like an unfledged dunnock. The unfortunate lad is the only one in all this parish that does not guess how he has been cheated."
"Well, Mrs. Dean, it will be a charitable deed to tell me something of my neighbours. I feel I shall not rest if I go to bed. So, be good enough to sit and chat an hour."
"Oh, certainly, sir. I'll just fetch a little sewing, and then I'll sit as long as you please. But you've caught a cold. I saw you shivering, and you must have some gruel to drive it out." The worthy woman bustled off, and I crouched nearer the fire. My head felt hot, and the rest of me chill. Moreover, I was excited, almost to a pitch of foolishness, through my nerves and brain.
This caused me to feel not uncomfortable but rather fearful, as I am still, of serious effects from the incidents of today and yesterday. She returned presently, bringing a smoking basin and a basket of work, and having placed the former on the hob, drew in her seat, evidently pleased to find me so companionable. "Before I came to live here," she commenced, waiting no farther invitation to her story, "I was almost always at Wuthering Heights because my mother had nursed Mr. Hindley Earnshaw, that was Harriton's father, and I got used to playing with the children. I ran errands, too, and helped to make hay, and hung about the farm, ready for anything that anybody would set me to. One fine summer morning, it was the beginning of harvest, I remember, Mr. Earnshaw, the old master, came downstairs dressed for a journey, and after he had told Joseph what was to be done during the day, he turned to Hindley and Cathy and me, for I sat eating my porridge with them, and he said, speaking to his son, 'Now, my bonny man, I'm going to Liverpool today. What shall I bring you? You may choose what you like, only let it be little, for I shall walk there and back, 60 miles each way. That is a long spell.' Hindley named a fiddle, and then he asked Miss Cathy, she was hardly 6 years old, but she could ride any horse in the stable, and she chose a whip. He did not forget me, for he had a kind heart, though he was rather severe sometimes. He promised to bring me a pocketful of apples and pears, and then he kissed his children, said goodbye, and set off. It seemed a long while to us all, the 3 days of his absence, and often did little Cathy ask when he would be home. Mrs. Earnshaw expected him by supper time on the third evening, and she put the meal off hour after hour. There were no signs of his coming, however, and at the last the children got tired of running down to the gate to look. Then it grew dark. She would have had them to bed, but they begged sadly to be allowed to stay up, and just about 11 o'clock the door latch was raised quietly, and in stepped the master. He threw himself into a chair, laughing and groaning, and bid them all stand off, for he was nearly killed. He would not have such another walk for the 3 kingdoms. "And at the end of it, to be flighted to death," he said, opening his great coat, which he held bundled up in his arms. "See here, wife, I was never so beaten with anything in my life, but you must even take it as a gift of God, though it's as dark almost as if it came from the devil." He crowded round and over Miss Cathy's head. I had a peep at a dirty, ragged, black-haired child, big enough both to walk and talk. Indeed, its face looked older than Catherine's. Yet when it was set on its feet, it only stared round and repeated over and over some gibberish that nobody could understand. I was frightened, and Mrs. Earnshaw was ready to fling it out the doors. She did fly up, asking how he could fashion to bring that gypsy brat into the house when they had their own bairns to feed and fend for. What he meant to do with it, and whether he were mad. The master tried to explain the matter, but he was really half dead with fatigue, and all that I could make out amongst her scolding was a tale of his seeing it starving and houseless and as good as dumb in the streets of Liverpool, where he picked it up and inquired for its owner. Not a soul knew to whom it belonged, he said, and his money and time being both limited, he thought it better to take it home with him at once than run into vain expenses there, because he was determined he would not leave it as he found it. Well, the conclusion was that my mistress grumbled herself calm, and Mr. Earnshaw told me to wash it and give it clean things and let it sleep with the children. Hindley and Cathy contented themselves with looking and listening till peace was restored. Then both began searching their father's pockets for the presents he had promised them. The former was a boy of 14, but when he drew out what had been a fiddle, he crushed to morsels in the great coat. He blubbered aloud, and Cathy, when she learned the master had lost her whip in attending on the stranger, showed her humour by grinning and spitting at the stupid little thing, earning for her pains a sound blow from her father to teach her cleaner manners. They entirely refused to have it in bed with them, or even in their room, and I had no more sense, so I put it on the landing of the stairs, hoping it might be gone on the morrow. By chance, or else attracted by hearing his voice, it crept to Mr. Earnshaw's door, and there he found it on quitting his chamber. Inquiries were made as to how it got there, I was obliged to confess, and in recompense for my cowardice and inhumanity, was sent out of the house. This was Heathcliff's first introduction to the family. On coming back a few days afterwards, for I did not consider my banishment perpetual, I found they had christened him Heathcliff. It was the name of a son who died in childhood, and it has served him ever since, both for Christian and surname. Miss Cathy and he were now very thick, but Hindley hated him, and to say the truth I did the same, and we plagued and went on with him shamefully. For I wasn't reasonable enough to feel my injustice, and the mistress never put in a word on his behalf when she saw him wronged. He seemed a sullen, patient child, hardened, perhaps, to ill treatment. He would stand Hindley's blow without winking or shedding a tear, and my pinches moved him only to draw in a breath and open his eyes, as if he had hurt himself by accident, and nobody was to blame. This endurance made old Earnshaw furious when he discovered his son persecuting the poor fatherless child, as he called him. He took to Heathcliff strangely, believing all he said, for that matter. He said precious little, and generally the truth, and petting him up far above Cathy, who was too mischievous and wayward for a favourite. So, from the beginning, he bred bad feeling in the house, and at Mrs. Earnshaw's death, which happened in less than 2 years after, the young master had learned to regard his father as an oppressor rather than a friend, and Heathcliff as a usurper of his parents' affections and his privileges, and he grew bitter with brooding over these injuries. I sympathized a while, but when the children fell ill of the measles, and I had to tend to them and take on me the cares of a woman at once, I changed my idea. Heathcliff was dangerously sick, and while he lay at the worst, he would have me constantly by his pillow. I suppose he felt I did a good deal for him, and he hadn't wit to guess that I was compelled to do it. However, I will say this, he was the quietest child that ever nurse watched over. The difference between him and the others forced me to be less partial. Cathy and her brother harassed me terribly. He was as uncomplaining as a lamb, though hardness, not gentleness, made him give little trouble. He got through, and the doctor affirmed it was in a great measure owing to me, and praised me for my care. I was vain of his commendations, and softened towards the being by whose means I earned them, and thus Hindley lost his last ally. Still, I couldn't dote on Heathcliff, and I wondered often what my master saw to admire so much in the sullen boy, who never, to my recollection, repaid his indulgence by any sign of gratitude. He was not insolent to his benefactor, he was simply insensible, though knowing perfectly the hold he had on his heart and conscience. He had only to speak, and all the house would be obliged to bend to his wishes. As an instance, I remember Mr. Earnshaw once bought a couple of colts at the parish fair, and gave the lads one each. Heathcliff took the handsomest, but it soon fell lame, and when he discovered it, he said to Hindley, "You must exchange horses with me, I don't like mine, and if you won't, I shall tell your father of the 3 thrashings you've given me this week, and show him my arm, which is black to the shoulder." Hindley put out his tongue and cuffed him over the ears. "You'd better do it at once," he persisted, escaping to the porch. They were in the stable. "You will have to, and if I speak of these blows, you'll get them again with interest." "Off, dog," cried Hindley, threatening him with an iron weight used for weighing potatoes and hay. "Throw it," he replied, standing still, "and then I'll tell how you boasted that you would turn me out of doors as soon as he died, and see whether he will not turn you out directly." Hindley threw it, hitting him on the breast, and he fell down, but staggered up immediately, breathless and white, and, had not I prevented it, he would have gone just so to the master and got full revenge by letting his condition plead for him, intimating who had caused it. "Take my colt, gypsy, then," said young Earnshaw, "and I pray that he may break your neck. Take him and he and be damned, you beggarly interloper, and wheedle my father out of all he has. Only afterwards show him what you are, imp of Satan. And take that, I hope you'll kick out your brains. Heathcliff had gone to loose the beast and shifted to his own stall. He was passing behind it when Hindley finished his speech by knocking him under its feet, and without stopping to examine whether his hopes were fulfilled, ran away as fast as he could. I was surprised to witness how coolly the child gathered himself up and went on with his intention, exchanging saddles and all, and then sitting down on a bundle of hay to overcome the qualm which the violent blow occasioned before he entered the house. I persuaded him easily to let me lay the blame of his bruises on the horse. He minded little what tale was told, since he had what he wanted. He complained so seldom, indeed, of such stirs as these, that I really thought him not vindictive. I was deceived completely, as you will hear. All right, there we go. That's chapter 4 done. Sorry for the stuttering and stumbling through that one. I don't know. Sometimes I can't read ahead quite as effectively as other times, you know. When you read something that's a little bit difficult to read, you kind of read a few words ahead of what you're saying so that you can smooth out the sentences. But tonight I was just kind of failing to do that completely, so I apologize for the shoddy reading. I think it's just down to tiredness, I think is all that is. Brain processing speed is not quite as high as it is sometimes. Anyway, hey, have your say about this chapter over at, reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I'll leave a few discussion prompts in the discussion thread, and I look forward to seeing what you have to say about this chapter. Other than that, that's going to do us for today. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.